find in Sawyer's same video on habitable worlds.
Great. Thank you all for coming on this depressing day. Appreciate it. It's going to be interesting. So I'm hard to pin down. I'm kind of a geomorphologist and a geochemist. I think Henry's last slide does well to introduce me in that I work on stuff that could broadly be defined as critical zone science. And specifically, I quantify rates that upland soils are produced and how quickly they erode. And when Jim and Henry were putting this session together, they asked if I could provide kind of that physical geomorph perspective on how we view upland soils. Many of my slides are going to be from the Atacama Desert. What I'd like to do, since this is an unfamiliar audience with probably much of our work, is go through our conceptual framework as it's here on Earth, explaining to you all how we quantify processes and rates of soil production as well as erosion, and focus in on what is steady state or sustainability. What is the sustainability of soils from our perspective? Showing you some data from around the world that can point towards how we might identify landforms that are in a sustainable state or a steady state. A lot of the data will focus then on the Atacama Desert and in the outback of Australia, two very slowly eroding landscapes and wrapping up. I really want to thank Ron. Ron and I have been to the Atacama Desert a great deal. He's kind of the one who got my head out of rapidly eroding mountain ranges and into slowly eroding landscapes like the Atacama Deserts. After many years, he and I and others published this review paper on hill slope soils and vegetation that I'll draw your attention to. I'm not going to summarize that or some of our other work, but some key points. Oh, it didn't update. Oh, well. Some key points from this paper was that basically a world free of life could largely be free of soils. Now, this is, I think, we know that this isn't the case, and so one of our questions is how do we interrogate a landscape to define how natural soil production works on places where we don't have life? Rates of production of soil, rates of erosion, are roughly an order of magnitude higher when you have life than when you don't have life. And the form, the landscape shape of that is reflecting the processes can be tied to life. And so there are many ways and many struggles that we all have for interrogating landscapes that are free of life. So I want to share with you a couple of my struggles. I had to keep this first point in perspective. If we really want to farm, we should terrascape the Sahara Desert, you know. Put in water conversion on the Mediterranean, put in organic material. It's a hell of a lot cheaper to farm the Sahara than it is to farm Mars. So let's get out of this mode that if we have 14 billion people, we need to go to Mars. We can go to the Sahara, to say nothing of this part of the world. But the big one that it will provide perspective of much of what I'm going to talk about is any of our farming. And Henry's slide at the end, which showed those containers, we're going to need to provide shelter. The Martian was a beautiful movie, and I think we're going to hear more about it today. But we're going to need to provide shelter, and we're going to need to input. We're going to need to put in that organic material, the potassium, nitrogen, phosphorus, that we need to grow food. And so given these two caveats, let me lead you through how we assess or how we deal with soil sustainability. And the key idea is that if soil production doesn't keep up with erosion, you're not going to have soil. Most of the landscapes I work on or we work on are eroding landscapes, even if they're eroding slowly. So if production doesn't equal or exceed erosion, we're just not going to have soil. We're going to have outcropping parent material or bedrock. And so our conceptual model for this hilly landscape, and I show a whole bunch of things here, is that as Henry's slide showed, you have unweathered bedrock, you have a weathered saprolite where you're losing mass through chemical erosion, and then you have a soil production by physical mechanisms, bioturbation, freeze-thaw, heating-drying, and salt expansion and contraction, converting the intact regolith, if you will, the weathered saprolite, into a soil. And our definition of soil is the mobile material, the stuff that is actually moving or being transported off the landscape by both physical erosion processes and chemical erosion processes. The lines here, I'm not going to get into the details, the lines are the concentrations of in-situ-produced cosmogenic nuclides. And that, this is way too short a talk to give you a total primer on that, but that's the methodology that we use to quantify the rates of soil production as well as the rates of both physical and chemical erosion. We use these cosmogenic nuclides, beryllium-10, neon-21, chlorine-36, aluminum-26. And so the data that you'll see today will be from that. And that conceptual framework comes from our upland soils, where we have these nice, smooth, convex uphill slopes. When we dig holes, we typically see stuff like this, where you've got a light-colored weathered granite here, a saprolite, a dark-colored organic-rich mollusol soil here. You can see the gopher burrows extending into the saprolite. That's bioturbation, actively converting weathered saprolite into soil and injecting the soil back into the saprolite. So there's this continual process of bioturbation. Those observations led to this hypothesis or this conceptual framework that has been around for a long time, which is that the production of soil from this underlying material is dependent on the overlying thickness of soil, because that's the ultimate mediator of these physical processes, whether it's freeze-thaw, which only can penetrate, you know, on the order of tens of centimeters, or the penetration of tree roots, which can get in several tens of meters sometimes. So the thickness of the material is going to help constrain the rate of production of the material. And then the slope and the curvature and the shape of the landform is being reflected or reflects the dominant erosional process. So the first kind of hypothesized notion of soil production functions is when you have soil production on the y-axis against the thickness, you could potentially have a peak of production under some finite thickness of soil, or you could just have an exponential decline of soil production rates with increasing thickness. Without belaboring the point, I went the wrong direction. Oh, no, I didn't. Anyway, to evaluate that, we need to quantify production, transport, and evaluate it from this notion of input minus output is equal to change in storage. You know, it's just a very simple mass balance perspective. So one of the problems when we go, when we take this perspective to any other planet, is what is a soil? And in these are several examples, a weathered sandstone mantled by that bioturbated soil, very thin in the California headlands, colluvial soil that is prone to landsliding in the Oregon Coast Range, and the soil formed from alluvial deposits on some river terraces in central California, soil slips. This may or may not be, all of these have dominance of life in them, and it's really hard to get away from life. So the forms of life, we have burrowing wombats. They, again, are getting through the saprolite and turning saprolite into soil. Trees tipping over, bringing the weathered material up and cascading them onto the surface, and microfauna such as worms getting all the way through the saprolite into this mobile material, or ants selectively bringing up quartz crystals from depth and onto the surface. All of these processes are life. We haven't actually managed to replicate or managed to get the same kind of rate dependency in pure physical soil production processes yet of freeze-thaw or wetting and drying. So using cosmogenic isotopes from around the world, this is just one example, we do find that the soil production rate decreases exponentially with increasing soil thickness. So you have some maximum soil production rate under very thin soils. And we think of that as the soil production efficiency. What is the maximum attainable rate under a given climate and tectonic setting? If we look from all over the world, from Australia to Chile to Korea, here are a suite of different soil production functions with a suite of different intercepts, the soil production efficiencies. The red one is just from South Korea, which was this study area that a postdoc of mine worked on. And in general, the slope of that decline is reflective of the dominant soil-producing processes. And for almost all of these landscapes, it's biota. It's not wetting and drying or halloturbation. So let's think about all these data in a different perspective to think about this concept of sustainability. Let's plot soil production on the y-axis against the average erosion rate on the x-axis. For all of the data that we have around the world, the only landscapes where you don't have this large scatter, the large scatter, by the way, are the independent soil production rates that define the exponential decline. For each of the sites, there's an average erosion rate associated with a catchment and then a suite of different soil production rates across that landscape that give rise to a soil production efficiency, which is the red symbol. And the spread of the data are those depth dependencies in soil production. But there are a handful of landscapes that can be thought of as equilibrium landscapes, where soil production equals erosion across all spatial scales. How likely is that? It's not that likely, but it's possible. And this is a slide from the Atacama to motivate what an equilibrium landscape might look like. Is this steady state where you've got your valley bottoms mantled with these kind of rocky, blocky, clastic boulders that we actually don't know where they came from because we can't see any outcropping rock up on the hills? The one place where we've done quite a lot of work to quantify it is the outback of Australia, where you have this constant shape, a diffusion-dominated landscape that is smoothly convex up and curvature. The curvature of the shape of the landscape is indicative of a creep-dominated erosional process, and it's constant everywhere. Soil thickness is constant. There's no spatial variability of soils. And the landscape itself, even through like a fourth-order channel, has this beautiful convex, concave, regularly spaced landscape form. The data where S is sediment and P is pebbles, and then all these black dots are soil production rates, define equilibrium. Soil production is equivalent across 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different soil pits, and it's equivalent in different channel sizes across all scales. So this might be an indication of a landscape which is in, quote, equilibrium. There's no kind of macro and micro adjustment of erosion to soil production. What about climate? How does climate change soil? There's been a fair bit of attention to this, and Justine Owen, Ron Amundsen's PhD student a number of years ago, found that for our temperate climates, there's a scatter of soil production when plotted against mean annual precipitation. But when you go from the hyper-arid to arid to semi-arid in the Atacama Desert, you actually see an increase of soil production with increasing precipitation. Across Australia, we divided it by climate zone rather than mean annual precipitation or mean annual temperature. So arid, semi-arid, subtropical, all the way through humid lowlands, we do see this average increase of erosion and soil production rates with increasing climate effectiveness, if you will. When we plot all of those soil production numbers together, including data from New Zealand, we do see that the erosion is more predictive of soil production rates, meaning the erosion is tectonics driven more than the climate is potentially. But there's a very strong correlation between soil production and climate. So to quantify erosion, I'm going to skip through this because it's going to take too long to explain and talk about what a characteristic landscape might look like. So the notion is that if you have a dominant erosional process that is being roughly balanced by a soil production process, your landscape's going to take on the shape reflective that erosional process. In the simplest sense, you have the convex up landscape that I showed you from Tyler's Pass of soil creep dominating. As soon as you get into threshold landsliding, you start putting in planar slopes, which could well be possible in an abiotic landscape. Saturation excess runoff is going to be very difficult to discern from a salt-encrusted landscape, a landscape that has basically ballooned outwards because of the aggradation of salts. And then pore pressure-driven landsliding is similar to threshold landsliding. But they all have characteristic forms, and we might be able to evaluate those to determine or to get some sense of what the dominant erosional process is. Using cosmogenic isotopes, again, is a conceptual framework. I probably don't need to walk you all through that. So I'm going to summarize three different studies that we've done in the Atacama Desert. Justine Owen, Ron's student, and then as well as one of my students. And leave with this question of, is the Atacama Desert a useful place to work as a Mars analog? So Justine looked at the sensitivity of soil production studies as well as soil transport studies to find that cosmogenic nuclides can effectively quantify the bedrock erosion. The hill slope erosion increases with a precipitation from about a millimeter to 40 millimeters per thousand years. The rates are not a function of soil thickness like they are in the more temperate landscapes. And the pattern lands that you see in the background, the zebra stripes, might be diagnostic of the absence of life resulting from the self-stabilization of the class. Matt Jungers, a student of mine, looked at a series of depth profiles to quantify fluvial processes active in the Atacama, recording millions of years of the process history on these surfaces, suggesting that hyperaridity came to rise in the early Quaternary. You have a great aggradation rates that are roughly equivalent to the soil production rates that Justine was quantifying, and you have active reworking of the sediments by this fluvial process, even though the landscape looks, quote, dead. So to conclude, a few thoughts. If we're depending on this mechanical in-situ produced soil, the easiest thing for us to do is to know E. E, the erosion rate, is much easier to quantify both by the form of the landscape as well as by the tools that we have available to us than soil production rates. If we assume equilibrium, we can quantify the rates of erosion. Wind, expansion, contraction, and water-driven. I'm hoping Jim's going to elaborate greatly on that in the next talk. Salt. All of our work in the Atacama Desert really got my head turned on to this notion of salt as both a soil-forming process as well as a, quote, soil. It is the surface of much of the Atacama Desert. I focused on mechanical. I'm hoping Ron is going to focus on the biochemical.